Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Radio Established to Address Life, Real Radio for short. And today this evening, we're going to continue our conversation on what the Wilmington, North Carolina insurrection of 1898, or as we typically refer to it, the 1898 insurrection of Wilmington, North Carolina. Last Saturday, we had the pleasure of having Professor Sandra Cosgrove, a history professor at the College of Southern Nevada, on to share her insights. And I appreciate all of the feedback from you all. So she has been gracious enough, partially because of you all asking for more. She is gracious and has come back to share even more details of some of what led up to the insurrection, what happened during the insurrection, immediately following the insurrection, and how that is relevant to where we are today. Also, appreciate the great feedback on our other panelists, Mr. Alex Cherub, a graduate of Northeastern University School of Law, who shared his insights as to what happened. Alex has been working in the civil rights and social justice field even before he received his law degree, and he has very pertinent insights, especially from his background as a descendant of people who were held in captivity in what some people referred to as concentration camps in World War II. In other words, his ancestors, people that he knew, grew up with, were in the camps. So he has a unique insight that he brings to the discussion. Normally, Real Radio is hosted by Brother Lee Vaughn and Sister Rashi. I don't know if Sister Rashi was able to make it tonight, so you may just be stuck with me in the air chair And Lee, if he can fit in, he will get in. So this is a special show. And this is a show on the anniversary of that insurrection. Some people even call it a coup d'etat. And coup d'etat being French, sort of the general translation of it is cut off the head or sever the head. And that's a coup d'etat, oftentimes referred to as a coup, a phrase we are not used to using when we're talking about American governance and American politics. And even though 1/6 has been referred to as an attempted coup, and I may stand corrected by the professor here in a minute, but I believe the 1898 Wilmington, North Carolina coup d'etat or insurrection may be the only recognized coup d'etat in the history of the United States of America. And it happened in Wilmington, North Carolina. That's right, North Carolina, not Wilmington, Delaware. And that's an important delineation, because who would think of Wilmington, North Carolina as being the pivot point to bringing Jim Crow back to the South in a way going for almost 100 years. Up until my lifetime, when I was a child, is when Jim Crow legally was no longer on the books. Hopefully one of the things that we'll talk about today is how laws made it institutional and how that does impact the mind or mindset, thoughts, and actions of people today in ways that we had not normally associated with the United States of America. So once again, I am the host sitting in for Brother Lee and Sister Rossi. My name is Rodney Smith, based out of Las Vegas, and our discussion tonight is going to be the 1898 insurrection, or some people call it coup d'etat, of Wilmington, North Carolina. And so that is an introduction of our show. Let's bring on some of the panelists, and so they can give you maybe a quick introduction of who they are, why they believe that this is relevant. And after our two panelists, and we may have a third tonight, if I'm lucky. Hopefully we will. And so let's get on with the show. I believe I'm going to bring on, I tell you what, let me bring on Alex Chirp. Normally I like to do ladies first, mainly because I'm old-fashioned, but because I actually don't know the professor's number and don't know which one of her is on the board. So for those of you who are panelists, if you can hit one on your phone touchpad, and that will let me know that you're one of the panelists. So I believe I see Alex is up, and Professor Cosgrove, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I have you. So I can do what I normally do, and my grandmother would be happy that I did it. Professor Cosgrove, I gave a brief introduction. I know that you are involved in so many other things, and I don't want to leave any out. So if you could please give a brief introduction of yourself and some of the activities that you have been involved in, and we'll get this show on the road after giving Alex an opportunity to do the same thing.
Okay. Thank you again for having me. I'm Sandra Cosgrove. I'm a history professor at the College of Southern Nevada, as you said. I've lived in Las Vegas since about 1986. I have a small nonprofit called Vote Nevada. And what I spend a lot of time doing is kind of helping people to understand civic processes, because sometimes that's how we disenfranchise people, is we don't really help them to understand how their government can work for them or how to navigate through processes. And so they sometimes feel frustrated and shut out, and sometimes they just stop engaging. And so I try to make sure that anything from registering to vote to filling out a business license to anything you need, that I'll help people do those types of things as well.
All right. Thank you so much, Professor. thank you for joining us tonight. And I believe we have Alex on the line. Alex, if I did try to give a quick introduction to you, but I'm sure there's many things I've left out, even though I think I've known you since you came into adulthood. But if you can share a little bit about yourself. And also, Alex, I want you to just share how this is relevant to you, considering the background of your family.
Yes, well, it is a pleasure to be here for this second discussion about 1898 in Wilmington and the history of these examples of white supremacy in the past. And it is a pleasure to share the time with Dr. Cosgrove again, who I have admired for many years. And the that is true, Rodney. I believe I've known you for a long period of time. I think I moved to Las Vegas in 2008 and met you through Samuel Smith, who was one of the first black fire inspectors in the Southern Nevada area, and also the oasis in Las Vegas through the Native Son bookstore, and my personal mentor, and the reason why I went to law school and now am an attorney. Sam Smith, of course, you, Rodney, and others were involved in the creation of The Gathering, up until the pandemic, met every Friday at noon at the West Side Bistro in the historic West Side of Las Vegas. And those discussions would often cover some of the same territory as this radio program. And we did mention Wilmington on occasion because of that important item that you mentioned, that this is the coup d'etat that happened on United States soil. As far as the personal impact on my life and on who I am is connected directly to the idea of restorative justice. My grandparents' generation were Japanese Americans during World War II and were rounded up at gunpoint and taken to internment camps throughout the West, where they were held in custody by the United States government because of the color of their skin, because of their race, that they were Japanese Americans or Japanese nationals. And that experience of my family has identified the importance of concepts like restorative justice, reparations, and truth and reconciliation, and that the power, the evil power of white supremacy has been in this country for some time and is the root of many of these horrific incidents of the past, and is linked to the direct founding of this country throughout. And we're going to discuss that today and also look at ways in which we can have truth and reconciliation, ways that we can have restorative justice, and ways that we can just have justice, period, related to these items. And I will point out, Rodney, that I appreciated your message earlier today to talk about restorative justice. I had not known this, but today Joshua Halsley, who was one of the individuals murdered in the massacre on November 10th, exactly 123 years ago to this day, was given an opportunity to be remembered and acknowledged through a funeral service. And somebody that we talked about last week or earlier this week, Reverend Barber, provided the eulogy. So we had a service and a funeral service that occurred today in Wilmington honoring one of the victims of this coup d'etat, of this massacre. And there is now a headstone at the cemetery where he was buried, and family members of Mr. Halsley, great-grandchildren, other extended family were able to participate. So this is an example of a form of healing, a form of truth and reconciliation, a form of restorative justice, and a way in which we can start really identifying the truth of the past of this country. And I think it's incredibly important to have this discussion on the anniversary, because we have a lot of parallel experiences that are going on at the current moment, and I look forward. And I know that today we'll be doing a lot of comparisons between today and the post-Civil War, post-Reconstruction, lost cause era in this country, and looking into ways in which we can ensure that the history is understood by all Americans. So it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you again for the invitation.
Well, thank you so much, Alex, for being here and sharing something very personal to you in what happened to your family. Telling of stories, it's hugely important to reaching people and developing an understanding of how these things impact us, those who are more immediately affected, but also how it impacts us as a state and as a nation, because what impacts one tends to impact many. And if these things go, it's almost like a physical injury. It may heal by itself, but it may get infected and spread and get worse to where it can kill the body. And if we look at our country as a body, then we have to ask the question, is first of all, does the body know that it was injured with the insurrection of Wilmington in 1898? And has that body healed perfectly fine on its own? Or has there been damage to that body that is still harming the body today? And that's what I hope that our conversation will eventually lead into, is what was the relevance, the impact of that insurrection, that coup d'etat in 1898, Wilmington, North Carolina? How does that impact who we are, where we are, and the mindsets of today? Professor Cosgrove, on that note, first of all, because you are the professor here, is there anything that I'm improperly characterizing in our discussion thus far of the insurrection or coup d'etat that happened in 1898? Please feel free to jump in and make sure that whatever I'm saying is accurate, and if it wasn't, to make it accurate for all of our listeners.
Everything you said is accurate. I would just maybe add in one thing, that there's a definite connection between what happened in Wilmington and happened in some other places, Tulsa being one of them, but it also has happened to Native Americans, and that's this idea of state violence and who is able to have the power to use state violence against someone else. And I mean, we've got, how many trials do we have going on? We've got the Rittenhouse trial, we've got the Arbery trial. You know, we just had the Coben trial with George Floyd's killing. This idea that some people that aren't part of the state get to exercise state violence against other people and get away with it is something that we're still having to reckon with. And the fact that we're actually doing it in a court of law this time is different. But we're still having to have a discussion over, is it okay for white men to use violence against people of color, and do they get punished if they do it?
Wow. So we're gonna put a pin on that, and I want you all to think about what the professor said, because I do think that that's a fairly deep comment, and I hope it's as thought-provoking in you all as it is in me right now, because the wheels are turning. Alex, can you maybe share how some of the laws of, well, you know what, before we do that, let me share with you all that I am actually from about 30, or my family is from about 34 miles south of Wilmington, North Carolina. And the reason why I wanted to share that, as we have many discussions on what should be taught in our schools, is that even though I am from that area, that was when we would go to town, what we were talking about was going to Wilmington. And this is back in the 60s when I was a little boy. And I graduated, I actually graduated high school in North Carolina. I was going to, my family had moved to New York during the Great Migration. I was actually a New Yorker, and my grandmother was ill, and my grandmother raised me on the farm when I was a very small child. And so I went, I left high school in New York my senior year, and a prominent high school, I'll put it like that. And I went back to North Carolina to finish high school and take care of my grandmother. And I had history classes there, and I'd gone to school in elementary school a little bit in North Carolina as well. My brothers attended most of their school in North Carolina. As a matter of fact, both of my older two brothers helped desegregate the schools nearest to me. But at no time in that education process in North Carolina, and like I said, I was 34 miles down the road from Wilmington, at no time during my life and visits in North Carolina did I ever hear about the insurrection in Wilmington. At no time. At no time in school was I taught about it. At no time from K through 12 did I hear about the insurrection of Wilmington, North Carolina. I think I got a taste of it in middle school from my librarian, who was a Jewish woman who was in the camps in Nazi Germany. And many of you know my story. She was very influential in pushing me to learn more history about our country and the unique role that African Americans played. But as far as any academic information on the insurrection of Wilmington, North Carolina, even in college, I did not hear anything in college about the insurrection of Wilmington, North Carolina. If it is true that it is the only recognized coup d'etat or successful insurrection in the history of this country, you would think that it is important enough to be mentioned in someone's, to be a part of history discussions throughout this country. So here's my first question to Professor Cosgrove, as well as to Alex. When did you all hear about the insurrection of Wilmington, North Carolina? And without you telling your peers, what percentage of your peers would you say also may have learned about Wilmington, North Carolina, or not, as they went to school? And we'll start with the professor. We'll typically go with the professor first. Professor Cosgrove?
Sure. So I learned about Wilmington and, some other instances of mass violence when I was in graduate school, taking a historiography class on the civil rights movement, on Reconstruction. And so obviously the people who I was there with, my peers, we all learned about it at the same time within graduate school. But as far as my friends that were outside of college, probably none of them knew.
So let's bring it to the present. Today, outside of the university setting, how many of the people that you generally associate with, whether professionally, outside of the academic arena, the history arena, or personally, would you say are familiar with the insurrection?
Probably specifically with the insurrection at Wilmington, I would say none. But most of my friends are aware of the massive amounts of violence that we've had in our history. So they are generally aware, but I don't think they would be specifically aware of that incident.
Okay, and then let me add an addendum to that. Why do you think that is? Since, this seems like a pretty big Well, a pretty big deal in a country that prided itself on, up until recently, always having peaceful elections and transfers of power.
It's a pretty obvious answer that when you look at high school history and the way it's taught, even in the undergraduate classes, for the 100-level, 200-level history classes, it's always a very cursory, just kind of high-level, the usual themes. If you'd have to actually get into a class in the upper division where they were specifically looking at time periods or very specific themes in American history before you would actually be exposed to this type of incident and anything that was anywhere similar to it.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Alex, the same question. When did you hear, when and where did you hear about the insurrection of Wilmington, North Carolina? And what number / percentage of your peers outside of the academic sphere and primarily history would you say knew about this?
I first heard about the Wilmington insurrection from Sam Smith, and much of the historical knowledge that I've become familiar with has some roots to Sam, and this is definitely one of the topics that I learned from Sam. As far as my peers, I'll speak directly to the attorneys that I encounter. I would say that virtually none of the attorneys in the community that I interact with consistently really think much about think about this topic, and unfortunately, there's not much of a connection to what is going on in practice versus the history of the law. I think in certain arenas and affiliations that I have, that there are a good number of people who have familiarity with the Wilmington insurrection, but those are individuals who are focused on truth and reconciliation and restorative justice. Outside of those circles, beyond me providing commentary on these historical items, I don't think there is a large number of my peers in my profession that have a great knowledge of the Wilmington insurrection. I could be wrong, and there could be folks who have familiarity with it, but I can say for sure that in a standard law school experience, you're not going to encounter the Wilmington insurrection unless if you're in a more specialized course that focuses on civil rights and history. So it is very unknown, unfortunately. I believe that recently there's been a shift and people have become more familiar with Tulsa because of the 100th anniversary and a few other public campaigns to focus on that massacre. Also, President Biden visited there this year, and there was a lot of news coverage leading up to the Tulsa massacre. I think the extremely objectionable choice of the previous president to have his first rally after the start of the pandemic in Tulsa on Juneteenth also has provided context to individuals to have some additional familiarity with some of these massacres. I think Rosewood is a little bit more known than Wilmington. I think Wilmington is distinctly in its own category, though, because it was a coup. And you can look at, say, John Hope Franklin's remarks. Just need to search his commentary on the Wilmington insurrection. And he's, as one of the premier historians, will talk about this as a coup d'etat. And that's why I think, Rodney, I think programs like this are very important, because there are all of these forgotten pieces of history that have such a substantial impact on how our country operates today that it's hard to imagine an understanding of American history without knowledge of the Wilmington insurrection. It's hard to imagine an understanding of American civics without an understanding of the Wilmington insurrection. It's hard to imagine what it means to be an American without an understanding of the Wilmington insurrection. So it is something that we continue to have to educate individuals about in order to get to that truth and reconciliation. So it is there is going to be a lot of work, and it is very difficult to have these discussions about how are we going to have this truth and reconciliation when people are totally unaware of the actual history, and that if you were to go to the average person on the street and say, you know, there was a coup that occurred on American soil, can you comment on that? Are you familiar with it? Even if somebody may have heard about the Wilmington insurrection on a news story or so forth, people wouldn't be able to connect the dots and see the impact and the significance of that point of history. So it is unfortunate, and like I said, in my educational capacity, I was not exposed to the Wilmington insurrection. It was through alternative means that I became familiar with it, and then through my work with the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project that we looked at the legal angle and viewed it from the lens of those of the reports and the historical narratives that have been developed afterward. So there's just needs to be so much more discussion, so there are not a majority of Americans who are unfamiliar with this particular point in history.
Well, thank you both for giving some insights into it. So let's get into what this insurrection was and how it came about. And for that, I turn back to our resident professor of the evening, Professor Sandra Cosgrove. I know we talked about some of this Saturday morning. Don't necessarily want to go into all of what we covered Saturday, but if you could sort of give the folks some background, is what led up to this insurrection in Wilmington, North Carolina?
So historically speaking, the time period we're looking at kind of the tail end of the Gilded Age. So we're looking at a lot of predatory capitalist behavior in the North, but also the end of Reconstruction. And so the federal government turning its back on emancipated slaves and their family and descendants. But this was also a time period, you can look in the labor movement with the Knights of Labor, you can look at the People's Party or the populist movement. There was a lot of average white people who were saying, you know what, my black neighbor's not my enemy. He's not the one that's harming me. It's J.P. Morgan. It's the capitalist class. It's the Wall Street folks. That's who's harming me. And so I need to stop trying to harm my black neighbor. I need to work with him. And so the Knights of Labor was open to everybody to join, and it was a multicultural organization, which was very scary for the kind of the white governing class. The People's Party also went down and organized among the black farmers in the South and started a grange movement with them and openly worked with them in public to do speakers bureaus and to do events. And so you also see something similar in Wilmington, where you have this kind of biracial government and people getting along with each other and, you know, white people going to black businesses and black people going to white businesses. That was a direct threat to this idea that we are a caste system and there is white people at the top and there are people of color at the bottom. And so the Knights of Labor were destroyed. They were wiped out. The People's Party was wiped out and Wilmington was wiped out. That there was this ultimate threat that you did not want to have successful examples of white people and black people coming together and white people letting black people lead and white people letting black people have property and success. That was a direct threat to our caste system, and it could not stand.
So let's get back to that threat, because threat implies that there is imminent danger, harm. What was the imminent danger? What was the harm that black people holding political office and living, in some cases, side by side with white people, with black people being employed and specifically being part of the established government of Wilmington, North Carolina. What was that harm? What was that threat?
The threat is competition, that you want to eliminate your competition. You don't want to have somebody that might be faster, smarter, work harder than you competing with you. So instead of doing what you're supposed to do in a political system that's a democracy or in a capitalist system where it's supposed to be open competition and the best person wins, white people ultimately were afraid of that. And so the Gilded Age is all about crushing competition, having certain people that just get a pass and they're the ones that get to have wealth and power, regardless of whether they're the smartest or the fastest or the best at doing something, and eliminating that competition, that you will not compete with me. And so ultimately, it's a fear within white people that they're not going to come out on top, that they're not going to win. And so instead of saying, no, I actually think I am better than you, so let's compete, ultimately they're saying, no, I don't know that. Deep-seated, I have a fear that you are better than I am, so I'm going to destroy you.
Oh, wow. And so that's actually a kind of simplistic look at it. And since you said it, I'm guessing that's what you believe. But from the historian's perspective, is that how it is categorized when you all are having the historian powwows to decide what is the actual facts of the matter?
What I just said is what historians, these are the types of conversations that we have, because what we do is we look at like the history of history, how was something first described? And like you said, that, for a long time, people didn't even know what had happened in Wilmington because of what was reported in the newspapers. Alex brought that up, that it was actually a riot that was caused by black people, that was all this misinformation that was given. Well, when real historians that are ethical start looking at what happened, I mean, you are looking at a bunch of white people who are definitely afraid of what was happening in Wilmington. They do the same thing to Native Americans. We're going to eliminate you with violence.
So let's get to that, because in America it's supposed to be a place where people can come from the four corners of the earth, so to speak, start with nothing, and reach the highest heights that their ability and vision will take them, and that is what we hear today. Work hard, come here, integrate yourself, immerse yourself in what it is to be an American, take on American values, you'll be accepted, and you will have this great opportunity. What was unique about black former Africans who got their citizenship with the 14th Amendment? What was different about them that caused such fear in white people, or was there anything different about them? Is this a fear that's innately in white people, of just people who come to America that aren't white?
Part of it is that, but again, it's the people at the top of the caste don't want to be moved down. And so you see a lot of the similar type of behavior within immigrant populations in places like Chicago. You're going to see it out in the West with the Chinese and Japanese Americans that come in, like Alex's family and what happened to them, that ultimately the people at the top are afraid that they shouldn't be at the top. And they don't want, they want to assume it's a meritocracy, but there's this fear that if it was really a meritocracy, that they might not be at the top. And so you set up a system that just naturally keeps people below you. And then we all share this lie that somehow it was a meritocracy and I got where I got because I worked harder than you did. But that's not true. That's not the way our system works.
Okay. Alex, what is your take on it?
Well, I agree with Dr. Cosgrove, and I think it's important to note that I think one of the elements of the lost cause, one of the elements of the big lie, one of the tenets of white supremacy is the idea that America was founded as a white nation, that America, that the Constitution, the Bill of Rights was meant for white people, that this was part of what it meant to be an American. And we can look at that through the statutes on immigration that started off, I think, the 1790 was the first federal piece of legislation that identified citizenship would be based on whiteness. And, of course, the 14th Amendment addressed that particular item, but feel that this is the representation of a particular view of individuals of a perspective that is about that power, about that identity that of this country. And we see countless Supreme Court cases following the 14th Amendment that apply to individuals who are non-white, immigrants who move to this country who are non-white, petitioning for citizenship and going all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court finding individuals either white or non-white based on their background and determining whether certain races are eligible for citizenship or not. 1921 or 23, the Thind case, for instance, for a Punjabi immigrant who was denied citizenship because he was non-white. There were a variety of different constitutional tests that were applied to determine if that immigrant would be eligible for citizenship. Indigenous Americans weren't able to access citizenship until 1924. So the 14th Amendment didn't grant citizenship to any immigrant. It granted citizenship to those born, and we talked about birthright citizenship previously, but to those born in the country. And the ex-president was very candid in his remarks, I believe it was to the Axios reporter, who was discussing the 14th Amendment and birthright citizenship, and the ex-president almost, it seemed, out of the blue, started questioning the concept of birthright citizenship. Even Senator Ted Cruz pushed back lightly against the criticism of the 14th Amendment's birthright citizenship clause. And that would factor into this idea that it's not based, that citizenship is not based on where you were born or your naturalization status, but based on the bloodline, right? That's another genre of citizenship that is, in my view, racist and problematic. And that is the opposite of what we have through the 14th Amendment. But still, the fact that in 2017 or 2018, you had somebody occupying the White House who was making comments of that nature is just shocking and unheard of. And that just demonstrates that there is this idea that somehow claim to this country is based on one's race. And this is something that behind the lost cause, behind the big lie, behind white supremacy views is this idea that this is a country for a certain race of people. And I believe that we forget about how enshrined in statute and in court decisions and in state law and in a variety of other different professional capacities, such as science and education, that in the law, the practice of law, that this was something that was ingrained in the perspective of the large number of individuals in this country. We look at the first, even in this state, right, the first licensed attorney, black attorney, was less than 60 years ago, where you had somebody who was able to practice law who was black in this country. The great Mr. Charles Keller. I think that's an important component based in the history of this country that needs to be identified. And Dr. Crossgrove talked last time, last session, about the Dred Scott case, Sanford v. Scott, and the language that is direct in that case from 1857, I believe, Justice Taney, who I think up until recently, I think they tore it down, had a statue in Maryland and probably elsewhere, probably one of the worst opinions in Supreme Court history. And we talked about this last time, but identified that the Constitution doesn't give any rights to a black man but a white man. And Taney was long in political power, not just in the judicial branch, but guess who's cabinet he was with previously, 30 years prior to that decision or thereabouts. He was in the cabinet of Andrew Jackson, one of the most white supremacist-based presidents in the history of this country. And so, and while in the executive branch of that administration, Taney was saying the same thing that was identified in the Dred Scott case. So it's not as if the Dred Scott case came out of nowhere. This was something that was established in the political class, in the law, in the understanding of people in power in America. For that was the trend of how that narrative came together. The idea of this multicultural democracy that we live in now was not in existence then. If you're thinking of the time period of Andrew Jackson, was that a democracy? Well, you had people who were enslaved, who obviously were not given the right to vote. You had people who were unable to vote for other reasons. Women were unable to vote. Indigenous Americans were unable to vote. So you had, is that a democracy or is that something else? And the idea of a multicultural democracy doesn't come until far later. And Dr. Kosgrove is so correct in pointing out that this was happening at a pretty rapid pace as we were entering, as Reconstruction began. You had all of these black elected officials during that period of time. And then this fusion, this connectivity, this synergy between different groups of people to try and find progress and to try and work together to fight those in control, those in a higher caste, those who were beneficiaries of an oppressive capitalist system. And that was the something that was a result of the end of the Civil War and Reconstruction and the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And we see that because there was that much success, there was that significant counter-revolution. And that's when the Klan was founded. That's when all of these more, another era of oppression and racism continued in white supremacy. So I think that's important that when we think about what drives this violence. That is a key component of it. And you see the folks in Charlottesville saying the same type of comments with the line that's often quoted, "Jews will not replace us," which is not only conspiratorial anti-Semitic trope that Jewish individuals are in control, but also that Jewish individuals will control the white population with workers of color, whether they be immigrants or citizens of this country who are non-white. And that is the framework. You see that in what Tucker, I hate to mention him again, but Tucker Carlson is talking about.
Oh,
when
my
he
goodness.
Mentions
we don't
white
use
genocide.
His name here, but I know you weren't aware of that, but sorry, make your point. Typically do not invoke the name of TC on the show.
I'm with you on that. Sorry for saying such a derogatory term. But he, even before he had his rapid rise to success, and I got to give John Stewart credit because John Stewart was ahead of the rest of the media when he called him out when he was over in at CNN. But for many years, he's been talking about, as well as others, this concept of white genocide, right? These ideas that there's an attack on whiteness, that the victims are white individuals, and that goes back to this very, very problematic history. And I think that it is important to keep in mind that these are not, that the Dred Scott case is not a singular decision, that Plessy v. Ferguson is not a standalone. And remember, there was only one dissenter on that case. So these are not items that exist in a vacuum. But this is the narrative of those individuals in power for some time. And the best example I can give of that as far as how this transcends branches of government and so forth is how long Taney was around making the arguments that he put into Supreme Court doctrine, jurisprudence related to that decision, that he was writing the same thing when he was with Johnson. So there's this is an important component to when we're talking about this particular incident in Wilmington.
That is a whole lot to digest, and thank you, Alex, for just calling it like it is. We've been on air for about 51 minutes. Thanks to all of our listeners out there. I appreciate you. I've posted the link for the show on Facebook. So if you guys see any of that and you have a question or comment, also posted it on my page. You can text message me. You can inbox me if you have a question or comment for either Professor Cosgrove or Alex. If you're listening through the internet but you want to call into the show, you can do that. It's area code 818-691-7348. Once again, it is 818-691-7348. And once you call in, just press the 1, and I'll see if I can get you in to ask your question. Professor Cosgrove, leading up to this insurrection, there was something called the White Declaration of Independence. And I don't know how commonly known this document is. Do you have any insight into why they felt they needed it? And do we hear similar comments in today's media market that pretty much says the same thing?
I've always wondered about that document and why they called it a Declaration of Independence and not a Bill of Rights, because it reads more like a Bill of Rights than it does a Declaration of Independence. If you look at it as a Declaration of Rights, they're asserting what rights white people have and what rights black and brown people do not have, and then differentiating between the two and why some people have rights and other people do not. And I still see that today, that some people are able to do certain things and don't get shot, and some people are able to do things and they don't get arrested, or they do certain things and they still get a promotion and other people don't. And so I always wondered why they called it a Declaration of Independence and not asserting it to be a white Bill of Rights.
So would that be because of, and I'm going to say that this was fake news before the term fake news came out with the past administration, but what do you think that has to do with the concept? And we did talk about this on the previous show, but I think it's apropos here. What do you think about the notion of Negro rule? Because then that goes back to your delineation of Bill of Rights versus Constitution. But so here's a quote, and I'm reading this quote from a book by David B. McCoy, the 1898 Wilmington, North Carolina coup d'etat. And the quote says, "To carry out his Negro rule and white supremacy campaign, Simmons put into motion a three-pronged strategy. Men who could write, speak, and ride." In other words, he wanted people who could sort of hit these talking points of Negro rule at the same time just opposed to white supremacy. And I wanted to read a few of the articles in this so-called Declaration of Independence so that you all would have an idea of what was being said. And some of the speakers, if you guys want to look them up, is I was about to mistitle him and call him the gentleman, but there was a fellow named Alfred Moore Waddell, W-A-D-D-E-L-L, the person who came up with the idea of coming up with this three-pronged strategy was named Furniford McLean Simmons. And what's interesting about Simmons is that my family carry the last name of Simmons. And it just made me wonder, is this like one of my family's former owners? So Declaration of Independence, White Declaration of Independence versus Bill of Rights, but what is the White Declaration of Independence in the first place? What role does the Declaration of this White Declaration of Independence play in the lead up and ultimate execution of the insurrection and what followed? So if you give me about 3 minutes, I'm going to read. So Alex, Professor, it's time to get some water. I'm going to read a little bit. White Declaration of Independence. Believing that the Constitution of the United States contemplated a government to be carried on by an enlightened people, believing that its framers did not anticipate the enfranchisement, interesting word, of an ignorant population of African origin, and believing that those men of the state of North Carolina who joined in forming the Union did not contemplate for their descendants subjugation to an inferior race. So that's sort of like the preamble, right? So then they get into some of these things. Actually, it kind of continues. We, the undersigned citizens of the city of Wilmington and county of New Hanover, do hereby declare, here's your declaration, that we will no longer be ruled, foot stomp, and will never again be ruled by men of African origin. This condition we have in part endured because we felt that the consequences of the War of Secession, it was a War of Secession, were such as to deprive us of our fair consideration of many of our countrymen. We believe that after more than 30 years, this is no longer the case, like there is no longer the case for having the Voting Rights Act, right? Continue. The stand we now pledge ourselves to is forged upon us suddenly by a crisis, and our eyes are open to the fact that we must act now or leave our descendants a fate too gloomy to be born. Wow. While we recognize the authority of the United States and will yield to it if exerted, we would not for a moment believe that it is in the purpose of more than 60 million of our own race to subject us permanently to a fate which no Anglo-Saxon, foot stomp, has ever been forced to submit. We therefore, believing that we represent unequivocally the sentiment of the white people of the county and city, hereby for ourselves and as representing them, proclaim. And then it gets into the actual, what, as Professor Sanjo said, is seems more like a Bill of Rights than a Declaration of Independence. So I want to stop there. Hopefully you guys got a chance, Professor Alex, the barrister, have had a chance to stretch a little bit. First of all, hopefully you were listening to me. What do you think about what I just read? And even though this was in 1898, what echoes of today did you hear, Professor, and then Alex?
Well, I definitely think they're confused and just being kind of vicious and angry because they say things that are contradictory. So they say they still swear allegiance to the federal government, but then our state and local governments are an extension of the federal government. And so basically they're saying we don't want to be ruled by black people and that we have the right to say no to that and do so in a violent way, that they feel like they're being oppressed. But they also, if you read between the lines, know very well that if they cross the line of secession, what's going to happen. And so they're having to be very careful and being very specific on who they're saying that they will not be oppressed by and who they will not be ruled by. And so they're being very, very clear. It's local. It's Negro rule. But please don't misunderstand them. They don't want to say that it's the federal government, so please don't think we're seceding. And so it's very kind of muddled. But, again, I think a lot of the document is just them kind of asserting white people get to do some things, black people don't get to do those things.
And the second part of that was what echoes of today, or I should say what echoes of the past, do you hear in the rhetoric of today?
Well, calling elections illegitimate and not being really clear on why they would be illegitimate, I think is an echo. Because obviously what happened in Virginia was legitimate because nobody's suing to recount the ballots there after the election mm-hmm. that we just had. And so it's very clear there, again, being very narrow in what's legitimate and what's not.
Okay. Same question to you, Alex. Same two questions to you.
Right. I do think that this is something that I'm sure people today who are believers in the big lie might actually, if you were to change a couple of the more antiquated terms, find compelling. And that's what is so frightening. I believe this is probably at that time something that was standard, well, even to this day in certain circles, that it's standard to have these types of views in those white supremacist-based circles. I think that there is number one is starts off talking about the importance of property ownership. The time has passed for intelligent citizens of this community owning 95% of the property and paying taxes in like proportion to be ruled by Negroes, showing that there is some connection of citizenship or of ability to vote to ownership, to property. The other pieces go in more and more. Number three, demonstrated by antagonizing her interests in every way and especially by his ballot, that he is incapable of realizing that his interests are and should be identical with those of the community, that the Negro has demonstrated that. We see, and this focus on voting, right? That the Negro has demonstrated by antagonizing our interests in every way, and especially by his ballot, that he is incapable of realizing his interests are and should be identical to those of the community. That's the attempt to overturn the votes in Wayne County, certain parts of Wayne County, to overturn the vote in Philadelphia for a recount in Pennsylvania and so forth. That's same type of mindset that exists. So we see these themes that are existing to this day. And if you think about it from the perspective of the legitimate votes, the individuals who should have the votes, are white individuals, then yes, the ex-president did win. right? If you're coming at it from the angle that's identified in this declaration, and that's identified by some to this day, and might be behind some of the thought process here, right? If you think that the legitimate votes, that the person who should have access to the ballot box, are the property-owning white folks, then that means that those are the votes that they're focused on. Those are the votes that they're counting and that should be counted, and that everybody else really shouldn't have access to the ballot box. And we see that in the declaration. So from that angle, there is maybe some motivation behind those individuals to move forward with these same principles in mind, to try and discredit the vote of non-white voters, discredit particularly the black vote. And we see that as for sure in the efforts of January 6th and the argument to overturn the election as being something that's prominent in the minds of those who are thinking. So when the ex-president says his supporters, you know, that they won the election, well, they're saying, well, they won the election with the votes that mattered, the white votes. And that's the type of evil that we're dealing with right here. I do like how we had and I mentioned this last time, we have the term Anglo-Saxon, and mm-hmm. that made the headlines back in April when you had the American First Caucus that, mm-hmm. Of course, Marjorie, I don't know if we're allowed to say her name, MTG, I don't want to say her name, and then the gentleman from Florida who is, I believe, under criminal investigation for his behavior with underage women, that there was a memo that was developed. And let me read some of the comments from the memo and compare it to what you read, Rodney. One of the lines is, quote, America, this is from the America First Caucus, America First Caucus group. Quote, America is a nation with a border and a culture strengthened by a common respect for uniquely Anglo-Saxon political traditions, unquote. Juxtapose that with what you read. Mm-hmm. The memo also reads, quote, history has shown that societal trust and political unity are threatened when foreign citizens are imported en masse into a country, particularly without institutional support for assimilation and an expansive welfare state to bail them out should they fail to contribute positively to the country, unquote. Well, that just sounds like the point that I mentioned earlier from the Declaration of Whiteness. I'm getting the name wrong. I'm with Dr. Cosgrove. It does seem more like the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, rather. And so you see those themes, right? The property, who has a right, who is legitimate, the need to assimilate, the supremacy of Anglo-Saxon political traditions. And I think the Declaration of Independence that you read uses the term Anglo-Saxon. And then what's interesting is the memo even says that, quote, this caucus, quote, will work toward an infrastructure that reflects the architectural, engineering, and aesthetic value that befits the progeny of European architecture, unquote. This is just outwardly the same type of language that we're reading in that declaration. The memo identifies problems of, quote, post-1965 immigrants, unquote, for hurting wages. Well, what's significant about that? Let's go back to what I was talking about the Supreme Court making determinations whether somebody is white or non-white. If you're a citizen, if you're a immigrant from Norway and you're white, citizenship. If you were at that in 1923, if you were an immigrant from the state of Punjab in India, you would not be a citizen. Now your children could because of birthright citizenship, but you were unable to because of that determination of non-whiteness. What ultimately put the final nail in that coffin? The 1965 immigration bill under LBJ. So we see this is from April 2021, where we're having these themes, where they're attacking the very statute that put an end to this focus on whiteness when it came to citizenship, They're identifying the importance of Anglo-Saxon political traditions and the need for common respect, the need to have forced assimilation, and that you can't have individuals who are bailed out by the welfare state. That goes into the comments about property ownership and who has control. And this is a directly white supremacist narrative that's being promoted by these current sitting lawmakers. And I think it's important, and that's why the declaration the declaration that you read is so essential, because we see that these themes are continuing to remain intact, unfortunately, in the present day. So a demonstration of what we see today, and this is not fringe movement commentary. This is not talk radio even. This is something coming out of the offices of current congressional representatives. So we can find it even in that group of people, statements that sound to have the same theme and tenor as what you read.
So, Professor Cosgrove, I want you to, if you have something to say about Alex's comments, to everyone out there who are listening, you are listening to Real Radio, Radio Established to Address Life. And this is November 10th, 2021, 123 years past one of the most consequential political acts that happened in this country, which was a recognized insurrection in the United States of America, the 1898 insurrection of Wilmington, North Carolina. This is the second part of that discussion with our guest, Professor Dr. Sondra Cosgrove, a professor of history at the College of Southern Nevada, and with our resident barrister, Mr. Alex Cherub, who actually hails from the Michigan area. What we're talking about is some of the things that led up to the insurrection. We're just over halfway of the show, and we're going to get into the actual insurrection, the immediate aftermath, and how it changed, North Carolina, ultimately the South, and this country for about the next 67 years. But before we go there, and so, Professor, hold your thoughts. I want to read, I don't know if I'll read all of them, but I do want to read, and Alex read some of them. I want to read some more of, I guess this would be their articles in their declaration. I'm not sure, but it says first, so I'll just read first verse. It says that time has passed for the intelligent citizen of the community owning 90% of the property and paying taxes in like proportion to be ruled by Negroes. Now, I did want to foot stomp on this and make a note that they're talking about Negro rule. Remember, that was Furniford Simmons' idea, was to talk about something that didn't exist to rile up the people, and specifically the poor people in Wilmington. Where have you heard that before, right? Well, just to be factual, and the professor, I'm sure she'll always correct me when I misspeak, is that only about 5% at best of offices in Wilmington, and that matter for the entire state of North Carolina, were held by black people. Now, 5% is a lot more than nothing during slavery, right? But still, it was only 5%, and they're talking about this being ruled by Negroes. Well, good grief. If 5% is overbearing, that would mean that they were 95%. That should have been a huge burden on the Negro at the time, right? I'm just trying to apply some logic, not sure if it works. Okay, second, that we will not tolerate the action of unscrupulous white men in affiliating with the Negroes so that by means of their votes, they can dominate the intelligent, wow, and thrifty element in the community, thus causing businesses to stagnate and progress to be out of the question. Now, I could foot stomp a whole bunch of those because what are we here today, right? Third, that the Negro has demonstrated by antagonizing interest in every way, and especially by his ballot, casting a vote, that he is incapable of realizing that his interests are and should be identical with those of the community. Well, for you all that may not have got the show Saturday, Wilmington, North Carolina actually had a dominant black, a majority black population, but only held 5% at best of the elected offices. But Wilmington, North Carolina had a majority black population. So just oppose that to what's being said. Fourth, that the progressive element, and keep in mind that they use words like antagonizing, and they continually talk about intelligence. Fourth, progressive element in any community is the white population. Is that true today? I'm sorry. And that giving of nearly all the employment to Negro laborers has been against the best interest of this county and city, and is a sufficient reason why the city of Wilmington, with its natural advantages, has not become a city of at least 50,000 inhabitants. Now, mind you, just about 43 years earlier, all black people were employed as slaves, though there was no money rendered. But suddenly now black people being employed for pay is an issue. But I continue. Fifth, and there's only a few more. Fifth, that we propose in the future to give to white men a large part of the employment heretofore given to Negroes, because we realize that white families cannot thrive here unless there are more opportunities for the employment of the different members of said family. What rhetoric have you heard lately that sounds very similar to that? Six, that the white men expect to live in this community peaceably, to have and provide absolute protection for their families, who shall be safe from insult or injury from all persons whomsoever. We are prepared to treat the Negroes with justice and consideration in all matters which do not involve sacrifices of the interest of the, here we go again, intelligent and progressive portion of the community, but are equally prepared now and immediately to enforce what we know to be our rights. Does that sound like a threat of violence to you? Seventh, that we have been, in our desire for harmony and peace, of course, all the previous rhetoric sounds harmonious and peaceful, blinded both to our best interests and our rights. A climax was reached when the Negro paper of this city published an article so vile and slanderous that it would, in most communities, have resulted in the lynching of the editor. We, the priests, deprecate lynching, and yet there is no punishment. So they're asking for punishment, right? Short of lynching, because they don't believe in that. Provide the courts, so they want the courts for this defense. We therefore owe it to the people of this community and of this city as a protection against such license in the future that the paper known as the, quote, Record, unquote, cease to be published and that its editor be banished from this community. Now, there is something called the First Amendment in this country, right? I'll continue. We demand that he leave this city forever within 24 hours after the issuance of this proclamation. Second, that the printing press from which the record has been issued be packed and shipped from the city without delay. That will be notified within 12 hours of the acceptance or rejection of this demand. If the demand is agreed to within 12 hours, we counsel forbearance on the part of all white people. In other words, stand back, stand down. If the demand is refused or if no answer is given within the time mentioned, then the editor, Manley, will be expelled by force. Do you remember any language similar to that during the insurrection? And then it ends, throughout the state and the city of Wilmington, there was little doubt Black and Republican fusionists would risk harm, perhaps death, attempting to vote. Alexander Manley had already left the city. This was issued to what they called the Black leaders in Wilmington, North Carolina. And when a lawyer was given this document to be given to, once it was signed by the Black leaders, was to return it to these white people that took charge. And if all of these demands were met, then they would have forbearance on Black people. What happened, and Professor Cosgrove will probably go into more detail, but what happened was en route to deliver this message to the white people, there were armed and mounted sentries that prevented Black people from moving in any direction towards a poll. So if you hear in places like Texas that passed laws for deputizing poll watchers and poll observers, this is what it harkens back to, is people with guns on horses, as we saw with the Haitians, preventing people from the vote. They prevented this gentleman from delivering the message. Therefore, the white people of the day took it as a sign that the Black people were in default of these instructions, and violence ensued. Professor Cosgrove, your thoughts on any of that?
Going back, as you read through it, so number one, when they're in the White Declaration of Independence, talks about to be ruled by Negroes. And then what does it say in number two? We will not tolerate the actions of unscrupulous white men who affiliate with Negroes. One and two. We will not be ruled by Negroes, and we will not tolerate white men who associate with Negroes in any way. And so I think sometimes, I mean, when you look at politics that's happening right now and you look at their grievances in this about jobs not being given to them, about them using state violence to decide, I don't know, maybe what curriculum is going to be taught in a school. We're seeing that in school board meetings right now. But
right.
I think when you look at the legislation, like the infrastructure bill on the Build Back Better bill, you've got people in Congress who are trying to say, we're doing as much as we can to get people, everybody, jobs and not discriminate and try and get everybody a job, because we know that's a problem and we're trying to recognize that. But then the other part of the members of Congress saying, but there needs to be more, that we now know that there's got to be supports for family, that there's got to be more. And the other side saying, well, we've gone far enough. We're going to do jobs and then that's going to be enough. The grievance was you didn't have, you know, we weren't being equitable about jobs. That's as far as we're going to go. And so we're still kind of arguing about the same things, about who gets jobs, who gets better paying jobs, what the wages are going to be. But again, one, we don't want to be ruled by Negroes. Two, we will not tolerate white men affiliating with Negroes. And I know I spend a lot of time talking with my students and my friends and that, talking about allyship and talking about what that actually means and talking about repercussions that can come if you're white and you're being a true ally. The threat of violence against allyship is still something that's real, that we need to take care of so that more people can be true allies and actually reach out to their neighbor, reach out to their black and brown friends and people of color and help them.
Wow. I'm going to admit, it was tough reading that, not so much because of the language in which it was written, but because it was, to a lot of it, some of, like the professor said, some of the words was changed. But it did sound a lot like things that we hear today. When we talk about, unfortunately, black people, we still tend to think of them as a criminal, a group of criminals and people of lesser intellect. So some of the same tropes that were used back in Wilmington, North Carolina before the insurrection, they sort of codified it in their Declaration of Independence that these Negroes are, well, if you're not intelligent, what is the opposite of intelligent, right? Now, these people had gone to school. Think about it. You were a slave. Didn't have the ability, because it was against the law, to learn to read and write. And suddenly you're free and you're, you know, go make it happen, right? And these people were educated. These people, well, they were pretty much all craftsmen and skilled in something, because that was what life was, to be a slave. And this was not that long after slavery. So many of these people, though there were some freed people in Wilmington, the majority of these people actually had been slaves. But these slaves now owned businesses. Some were in elected office, these former slaves. And so in reality, they tended to typify how much lower can you be than a slave, right? And then how much higher can you reach from being a slave to a business owner and an elected official within 40 years? That doesn't sound like people who are lazy, people who are unintelligent, to have the ability to gain intelligence and then to exercise it. But once they were enfranchised, because that's the word he used, once they were enfranchised, all of a sudden, 40 years later, white people are feeling threatened because they're working and actively engaged in politics and voting. Alex, any comments?
I would agree, and I think Dr. Cosgrove's comments are very on point, as well as we think about some of the themes that we encounter today. It's important also to note that this was published in the newspaper and the News and Observer, I believe, on the day of the insurrection. So you do have the kind of almost frightening prospect of this being published in the newspaper on the day of the coup d'etat, and you know, that when the insurrection occurs. So it really is important to think about, I believe, this, and maybe that is that must be the context behind this Declaration of Independence. It was the removal of the elected members of the local government and the replacing of those individuals with the white supremacist candidates, or the white supremacist soon-to-be leaders. So I think this reinforces the idea that what happened in Wilmington, the insurrection, was a coup, and that this was the Declaration of Independence from that Negro rule, and also from the actual individuals who had previously been in power and were working toward this multicultural fusion government. And that's why the references to allyship are present there as well. So it really is frightening to think about this particular, and we talked about this last time too, the importance of primary sources when we're looking at items in history, so it becomes non-negotiable. This was something composed on that day, or published on that day, and composed for this outcome, to demonstrate that the white supremacist inclination and effort, inclination of the participants of the coup and the effort, the white supremacist effort underway. And the fact that we, again, don't have knowledge of this is quite frightening. And people might not be familiar with Wilmington 1898. I think people are even less familiar with the fact that there was a white Declaration of Independence composed directly affiliated with the coup. So I believe big picture when we're talking about the insurrection, this is very important, and it does identify as well this cause. It talks about Manley, and it talks about the editorial that was composed. And of course, we've discussed previously what was that editorial about. That editorial was about interracial relationships and the idea that there were white women and black men in consensual relationships, and that it was not assault that was at the root of these relationships. So
Alex, that is going to be a great segue. That's going to be a great segue. I did want to mention that Alexander. Oh wow, Alex, do you know anybody else named Alexander? Anyway, that Alexander L. Manley was his name, and Mr. Manley, check this out. He was actually his great-grandfather was a white man and had been the governor of North Carolina. Imagine that. So I don't know what biologically that would be, 33%, but Mr. Manley was, you know, he was a biracial individual, to say the least. And what his paper was known for was it was called A Daily Record, and it encouraged black civil rights, better health care, roads, even bicycle paths. It encouraged black people to become equal economically, politically, socially, culturally, and his relationship with the white people in Wilmington was good. As a matter of fact, many white businesses advertised in his newspaper. His newspaper happened to be the only one in Wilmington, North Carolina, and it was one of the largest black newspapers in the state of North Carolina, and maybe one of the largest black newspapers in the country at the time. This was Wilmington, North Carolina, was the largest city in North Carolina at the time, just to kind of give you a framework of when we're talking about an insurrection in Wilmington, North Carolina. You're talking about a very prominent city in a state in 1898. And when you're talking about this newspaper, this was a very influential newspaper. And Alex mentioned it, and I just want to go into it briefly. The article that seemed to set these people off was published by Manley, and we didn't really get into it before, but it was written by Rebecca Felton. And Rebecca Felton actually courted her husband, who was a Democrat. And let me just give you a little insight into who she was. Because she was she wrote speeches, she delivered speeches for her husband. But this is what they, together, the Feltons promoted penal reform, temperance, and women's rights. Sounds fairly decent, right? Felton, and I'm reading from the book here, Rebecca Felton was equally outspoken in her prejudice against African-Americans and supported lynching. Felton considered, quote, young blacks, close quote, who sought equal treatment, this is a quote, half-civilized guerrillas, close quote, and ascribed to them a, quote, brutal lust, close quote, for white women. While seeking suffrage for women, she decried voting rights for blacks, arguing that it led directly to the rape of white women. Now, I don't know how she put all that together, but that is who wrote the letter, and what her letter. So here's a little more just to give you an idea of who this woman is. As part of the conservative propaganda barrage, the messenger reprinted a year-old speech by Felton urging white Southern men lynch 1,000 times a week, if necessary, close quote, to protect white women from black rapists. In response to this fabricated rape scare and call for mass murder, Manley wrote an editorial response which seemed heaven-sent to Democratic and Secret Nine leaders. Okay, so because this letter tended to be the ignition for the insurrection, and it's short, I'm going to read it. A Mrs. Felton from Georgia made a speech before the Agricultural Society at Tidby, Georgia, in which she advocated lynching as an extreme measure that would make a strong plea for womanhood, not sure how that works, and if the alleged crimes of rape were half so frequent, plea would be worthy of consideration. Now this is Manley's rebuttal to her, right? The papers are filled often with reports of rapes of white women and the subsequent lynching of the alleged rapist. The editors pour forth volumes of aspersions against all Negroes because of the few who may be guilty. If the papers, and where else does those types of aspersions happen in American society today? I inserted that. I continue to read. If the papers and speakers of the other race would condemn the commission of crimes because it is crime and not try to make it appear that the Negroes were the only criminals, they would find their strongest allies in the intelligent Negroes themselves. Our experience among poor white people in the country teaches us that the women of that race are not any more particular in the matter of clandestine meetings with colored men than are men with colored women. Meetings of this kind go on for some time until a woman's infatuation or the man's boldness brings attention to them, and the man is lynched for rape. Ellipsis. Tell your men that it is no worse for a black man to be intimate with a white woman than for a white man to be intimate with a colored woman. You set yourselves down as a lot of carping hypocrites in that you cry aloud for the virtue of your women while you seek to destroy the morality of ours. Don't think ever that your women will remain pure while you are debauching ours. You sow the seed, the harvest will come in due time. That, Dr. Cosgrove, thoughts?
Yeah, we kind of mentioned this on Saturday a little bit, the kind of weaponization of white women in the kind of the white supremacy ideology. And notice that the woman in question, the white woman in question, was speaking in public when she was talking about this. And sometimes that's the way white women were able to get out of the house, and they were able to have standing in the public, and they were able to be taken seriously by the men, was to go ahead and capitulate and become a weapon that was used in the way that she was allowing herself to be used. And they wouldn't, and white men did not want white women getting outside of that. And so I could see the rebuttal that came back from Manley as being a threat, not only in kind of just calling out the hypocrisy of what was going on, but also kind of calling out that the white woman shouldn't be doing what she was doing and saying, you know, that people should be lynched and that this was a problem. And so by directly rebutting her argument, it's kind of rebutting the fact that when white women had been weaponized and were using that sometimes just for their own self-interest.
Okay. So Alex, did you have a comment or you want us to go ahead and move on?
I find that very insightful, Dr. Cosgrove, and also that Rebecca Felton was somebody who had a storied career as a politician and was the first woman to serve in the United States Senate, I think for it was like a 24-hour period of time when she was in her 80s. And that she was married to a politician, and I believe was a slave owner prior to the Civil War, and that this was somebody who had become like Dr. Crossgrove is saying, successful. Using those images, and that was something that seemed to be heavily endorsed and was, I guess, helpful in the in her political career as she moved forward, and that this was something that was being this was a person from Georgia, so she was not a member of the Wilmington community. She was not somebody who was present physically in the area, but still that this narrative was being carried. And the aggressiveness of the comments that she made, the racism, the white supremacy, are so vile that you can see that this was something that was definitely influence in the consciousness of the South at that time, and that to speak out against those remarks demonstrates that type of response to speaking out to those types of remarks represents how embedded this type of white supremacy was in throughout the South. And that is very, very frightening.
So what we have done on the eve of Veterans Day as a holiday, I don't believe had been invented just yet. But on the eve of Veterans Day, today we're talking about the insurrection of Wilmington, North Carolina. The reason why I brought that up is because oftentimes today when we hear things associated with race relations, we often hear about the brave men and women who fought, sacrificed, and died for this country and for the flag. Well, when the insurrection in Wilmington, North Carolina happened, it happened with the help and support of the local militia. Basically, you could call it their version of the National Guard. Were part of the insurrectionists in Wilmington, North Carolina. So think of the military using force to overthrow a duly elected government. They used a Gatling gun. They bought other guns. They killed people on site. They went after specific people. Their plan was to make the New Hanover the Cape Fear River run red with blood. And if you were in their way, they killed you. What's interesting about this is some of these people, these were some of their neighbors that they killed. Think about that. So we have the insurrection. We have the violence. We have the killing. They use the letter as a catalyst to action. And the lack of delivery of the response from the black leaders to condemn Manley, which they did actually, just the letter was never delivered. So we have the insurrection. They have aldermen, not city council people, same function, different title. They remove the seated, the duly elected officials, replace them with white supremacists. And when I say white supremacists, those are not words that I created for this show. These are words they use themselves in their own Declaration of Independence. They replace them with white supremacists, and then they tell the mayor he needs to resign by threat of force. Where has that happened recently? And then once he resigned, I believe Furniford Simmons and Alex or Professor, correct me, appointed himself as mayor. That is the coup. That is the successful insurrection, was the overthrow usually by force of government. Insurrection of Wilmington, North Carolina in 1898. That's what happened. Now let's get into the after, the effect of the overthrow in Wilmington and how that led to changing not only Wilmington, but North Carolina, the entire South, and pretty much lasted, how that was a catalyst to the movie Birth of a Nation, and how Birth of a Nation was a catalyst to the massacre of Black Wall Street in Tulsa. Professor?
So, interesting question. I mean, I think there was different kind of threads that were starting to come together at about the same time that this happened. And so on the one hand, you've got something like Birth of the Nation coming back, and you've got a revival of the Klan and this kind of even just whitewashing of the Klan, because the Klan had gone away for a while. President Grant had gone after the Klan to kind of tamp it out. So that was there. And this is the contradiction within the progressive movement. Because Woodrow Wilson considers him a progressive and yet himself a progressive, yet as president he shows Birth of a Nation in the White House. But then you've got the Roosevelts, and both Teddy and Franklin, later with the New Deal, are in some ways trying to address what showed up in that White Declaration of Independence, trying to make sure that they were shoring up union rights, trying to make sure that workers were taken care of, trying to make sure that there was safety on the job. But neither of the Roosevelts would address the violence, and this is one of the reasons that Eleanor Roosevelt would have strong disagreements with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, because Eleanor knew that in the South they were withholding New Deal programs from the Black community, and that they weren't equitably being given the jobs and the resources, and she wanted her husband to do something about it. But the progressives wouldn't. They wouldn't address the violence. And so you have somebody like Woodrow Wilson openly showing, you know, Birth of a Nation in the White House, but then other progressives that were trying to address some of these issues refusing to deal with the violence. And we have that problem today. I mean, we're talking about what happened on January 6th in kind of sanitary terms of, you know, what, you know, people being upset with the government. But it was just raw violence, and we don't know how to deal with it, and we need to figure out how to deal with it.
So, Professor, is it that we don't know how to deal with it, or we won't deal with it?
It's both. Because we're seeing this with these trials that are going on right now, that when you're looking at Ahmaud Arbery, there was a law on the books that said those white men could do a citizen's arrest. And so they're having to deal in that case. Is that right? Should you be able to do that? And that question is actually coming up. And so we're having to face facts that these things are embedded in our legal system. They're embedded in our laws. They're embedded in our practices. And ultimately, each one of them enables violence. And so we're going to have to say no more state violence at the hands of average citizens. In other conversations, we have to have a conversation about criminal justice reform and state violence. But it's the violence part that we refuse to be honest about.
So before I go to you, Alex, one more question for the professor. When you talk about that ability for the citizen's arrest, it reminded me of one of the provisions in the Texas law. And it basically deputizes citizens to become poll watchers to ensure that there's no fraud. And I've read the story of Wilmington, North Carolina many times, and I've talked about it on my radio show every year before it became something that has been more into the general populist discussion. But what gets me about that is not only is it violent then, but because when they start talking about deputizing poll workers to protect the voting locations and ensure there is no fraud, I just have this image of this guy with a red shirt on and maybe even a white Dunsell wasn't a bad person, so I shouldn't use it as a pejorative, but with a pointy white cap on with the eyes cut out, patrolling with a gun and intimidating people to vote, which is why we got the – that was part of the Voting Rights Act, was voter intimidation was not allowed, and it used those as examples. Do you see parallels between the two?
Oh, I mean, definitely. And you bring up Texas and deputizing people to enforce the law. Apparently, you know, we've lost control of women. So what did they just do with that abortion law in Texas? Allow anybody to be deputized to drag a woman into court. And so, again, it's these kind of themes that keep popping up. But again, it's also this idea that the state is empowering average people to commit violence against other citizens. And ultimately, that's what the Supreme Court is going to have to rule on. And I think that's what they're struggling with, because they've never been put into a position of having to say the state has to stop doing this. We can't deputize people to commit violent acts against other people, period, regardless of what they're doing.
Okay. We have about 6 minutes to go before our show comes to an end. And I don't know about you all, but time has flown by. I can listen to both of you apparently for hours. I do want to go into and Alex, if you can kind of break it down in a succinct manner, what were some of the laws that, and Professor Cosgrove mentioned a couple, but what were some of the laws that were changed, and how did Wilmington, North Carolina, the insurrection there, impact the rest of the state and also the laws in the South that really impacted me because I was born during Jim Crow. Can you share some of the laws that came about and how it actually changed the South?
One of the most obvious is the fact that there, after 1900, 1901, there were no elected black officials in Congress and the Senate for decades and decades and decades. Congressman White, I believe, was the last black congressman for a long, long period of time. And so that was immediately following. I believe that what's going on in Wilmington, this insurrection right here that we're discussing, is linked to a few other items as well that transitioned the law in a particular direction. Not to say that the law was all that necessarily supportive of black folks at all, but it was far more supportive because of those amendments that we discussed. But 1896 is Homer Plessy, right? Plessy v. Ferguson, which then transitions the state laws, local ordinances, and so on into a separate but equal structure. And that's where segregation really is now legitimized in the Supreme Court. Now, we saw segregation throughout the century before Plessy, the Plessy decision, and we saw it in northern states as well. We had it in New York, you know, it segregated transportation, segregated schools, and so forth. But separate but equal is Supreme Court jurisprudence, Supreme Court a doctrine when 1896 rolls around. Jim Crow laws were starting to form in the South in the 1880s and started to populate the books fairly quickly after that. The deputization that we're talking about here is often part and parcel, though, with Jim Crow. And I think this is important. At a later date, we can talk about the Fugitive Slave Act and the deputization of whiteness through that particular federal statute. That's another discussion, but it's important to note that whiteness was deputized. That's what Dr. Cosgrove is talking about when we are talking about Ahmaud Arbery and the lynching on the street in Georgia from last year. The Fugitive Slave Act required that if there was an escaped slave, that a white man became the law and would not only be deputized and be able to capture that slave, but also would be required to do so. But what we see in the Jim Crow statutes, and we see it alarmingly in these laws that are coming into existence during this period of time, is that along with segregation is the deputization of state employees, bus drivers, you know, when buses come around, streetcar operators, rail car operators, that if you're going to join a streetcar or go on a streetcar, that the person who's running that streetcar is armed and deputized. And you see in the statutes, in the Jim Crow statutes, that we have segregation and we also have the deputization of white workers in power in the public sphere. And I think that we see in Wilmington that deputization, that part of Jim Crow. And I would say we don't have segregation as far as on the books like the Jim Crow laws currently as they exist because of certain progress. But on the other hand, the deputization, which Dr. Cosgrove is talking about, the deputization of white individuals, the citizen's arrest, the power of a white man to have a gun while they're providing service in the public is something that is directly linked to some of those Jim Crow statutes. And you just need to look at some of those Jim Crow laws and you see not only is there segregated transportation, for instance, segregated services, but there's armed white people at the helm of those services. And you do see protests, some of which happen in different states.
Alex,
I believe one in North Carolina,
Alex,
protesting
Alex,
that particular deputization.
Alex, I have to interrupt because we're coming down to like the last 2 minutes. So if you could button that up and I give Professor Cosgrove the last word in the discussion tonight.
Yes, ultimately, that Jim Crow laws include segregation and they include the deputization of whiteness and deputization of white men in the public sphere.
And I agree with that.
Professor Cosgrove, as we talked about that and we talked about these abortion laws, I believe a part of the abortion law in Texas was that it kind of deputized people to not just go after the person who's had this so-called illegal act, but then to go after anyone that helped them. So it was almost like the Fugitive Slave law with a little extra. And so we have two minutes. Professor, if you could go ahead and button us up on our discussion this evening and whatever else you would like to share.
I'm just hoping that we're going to see more court cases where they're going to challenge that abortion law in Texas because they're trying to argue that, you know, it violates Roe v. Wade. I want to see more court cases that challenge citizens' arrest and deputizing people and saying this idea that some people get to use violence against other people with the blessing of the state has to end. This cannot be a civilized democracy if we allow that to happen any longer. It has to end.
Well, so we have been listening to our two esteemed guests, Dr. Sandra Cosgrove, professor at the College of Southern Nevada, professor of history, and Alex Cherup, a graduate of Northeastern Law School. And we've discussed the insurrection, the 1898 insurrection of Wilmington, North Carolina, a successful coup d'etat on American soil. And then we tried to relate it, what happened, how it happened. We discussed the white Declaration of Independence and how it played a role also the aspersions of black men and relations to white women, and a response by a local newspaper owner, Alexander Manley, that sparked the insurrection and the violence, the deaths, the massacre in Wilmington, North Carolina, and the subsequent impact that it had in ushering in Jim Crow to Wilmington throughout North Carolina and the South for about the next 67 years. I would like to give a special thanks to Lee Vaughn for allowing me to use his platform to bring to you all what I think is a very valid and pertinent discussion of our history that's relevant today. And thank you very much to, once again, to my guest, Professor Cosgrove, and to Alex. I look forward to further discussion to delve into maybe some of the areas that we that this touched on tonight. To all of the listeners out there, thank you for listening. And please, if you have any thoughts, share them on our Facebook page. And like many of you do, I'm sure you will text me and inbox me. So you've been listening to Radio Established to Address Life, otherwise known as Real Radio. Normally we come on Saturday mornings at 8 o'clock on the left coast, the west coast, and that would be 11 o'clock on the east coast. Thank you all very much. And until Saturday, Veterans Day is tomorrow. Hopefully think about Wilmington, North Carolina, as we do recognize the sacrifice of our veterans. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for being a part of the show. And I hope that you have a good night. Good night, everybody.
Thank you, Rodney. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you, Rodney. Thank you, Dr. Cosgrove. It was an honor. Take care.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.